I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. We've been Disney fans our entire lives. And now, as childless adults, we're undertaking a journey through the media that shaped our lives.
Trying to find out if what made them special is still there.
We are Rewatching the Magic.
Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Tuesday. Wait. You were supposed to be making a podcast. Have you made my podcast yet?
I'm in the work meetings of working.
No. Tony Stark was able to make this podcast in a cave with a box of scraps.
I'm sorry, I'm not Tony Stark.
Well, crap. Okay, so we don't have Tony Stark, so we got to do this ourselves. We apologize for the inconvenience.
Yes. We are finally jumping into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the biggest money-making franchise of all time that made the biggest movie of all time. And it all started here in 2008. We're going all the way back 2008 to the one that started it all, Iron Man.
Wait a minute, though. This isn't a Disney film.
No, well, it really originally was not. This was before Disney actually bought Marvel. So this is another first for us, an acquired movie. Because we know Disney acquires everything.
Disney will own everything. Disney will own your soul.
Yep.
So, yeah, this is our first trip into the broad spectrum of things that Disney did not originally make under their own one of their own studio imprints, but actually bought wholesale from another company later.
Yep, Disney would buy Marvel in 2012, right around the release of the first Avengers movie. Pretty much they had the grip on girls' entertainment with the Disney Princess line and the Disney Fairies line, but they really didn't have anything that would be successful with boys. You know, it's not like they owned Power Rangers at the time or anything.
Yeah,
that's still a sore spot on me for that one. But we'll get to that when we cover Power Rangers. Oh, we will cover Power Rangers. So yeah, this movie, Marvel was independent at the time, and at the time they were working with Paramount Pictures to produce these films. They would produce it in-house.
Distribute the films.
Yeah, it was purely a distribution deal with Paramount. Marvel would make their films in-house with their own studio. They made their own movie studio, and pretty much at the time they had the very big success of the first Spider-Man movie with Tobey Maguire. And also there was the X-Men movies from Fox, Sony with Spider-Man movies. So they wanted to a piece of that pie too, but their big, most popular heroes were owned by other studios. So they had to get by with what they had. So they
And what they had was, at the time, what comics fans would kind of consider more the B-team.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much A-Squad was Spider-Man and the X-Men. You could say the Fantastic Four, but I wouldn't count them. Not at that time.
Yeah, well, yeah, not at that time. People outside comics fandom, they knew Spider-Man. There had been, cartoons and stuff for years. They knew X-Men, same thing. They knew the big ones from DC. They knew Superman. They knew Batman. But not a lot of people in 2008 in the general public were familiar at all with Iron Man. They would know the name, and they would kind of know the song, you know, and everything, which not really connected, but as far as, like, if you ask them, like, who is Iron Man's secret identity, or, you know, what's the background of the character, they couldn't have really told you anything about him.
And it's not like Iron Man wasn't, used in media. There was the Marvel superhero show in the 60s. There was the Iron Man animated series in the 90s. But those weren't really long-term shows. You know, those were not shows that you can go back and people will remember what they were. You say Spider-Man, everyone will know that Spider-Man. Yeah. Everyone knows that.
And they will know he's Peter Parker, and they will know that he's a kid from New York, and they will know he got bit by a radioactive spider. But if you're like, hey, how did Iron Man become Iron Man? They're like, he found a suit in a garage somewhere? I don't know, dude. You know?
Yeah. So
I was huge and have been for a while. I consider myself very deeply a Marvel Comics fan. Specifically for the X-Men. The X-Men was really my entrance into Marvel Comics as a kid, and I was very deeply into that. I was into Spider-Man. I was into a few of the other lines. And even though I would have considered myself a Marvel fan and would have known a little bit more than the average public, even I didn't know a lot about Iron Man. I knew kind of the basics. You know, I knew that it came about originally because of things that had happened in the Vietnam War. It was Marvel's commentary on the war profiteering and the collateral damage that we saw so greatly during the time in Vietnam, that it was an industrialist who is shown firsthand the horrors that his war profiteering has wrought on an entire people. And that after that, you know, he builds a suit and he becomes a force for good and doesn't want to be a part of that military industrial complex anymore. That part was kind of, I knew that. And I also was very familiar with the Demon in a Bottle storyline, which sadly they have never done on film.
Unfortunately, I don't think they can since, you know, Endgame and all.
Yeah, and that is very sad because for those of you who don't really remember and were not maybe a part of the hardcore comics fandom in, you know, like 2006, 2007 when they first announced that they were doing this. They kind of originally came out with, Marvel is starting their own film studio, which was a huge risk. Like, that was unprecedented, really.
Especially since at the time, Marvel had just come out of bankruptcy.
Yeah, Marvel was not doing well as a company, and for a while we thought the whole comics publishing end of it was going to fold. I mean, there was real concern among comic fans that Marvel would have to sell to DC and there'd be like a conglomeration under the DC side. And, you know, you think Star Wars versus Star Trek is bad. Get into a Marvel versus DC argument sometime. So, you know, comic fans, especially Marvel comic fans, were terrified at the time. And they finally pulled themselves out of bankruptcy. And then they were like, and now that we're like backed just a few inches away from the cliff, we're going to start a whole film studio. And we're going to get into making comic book movies, which despite the fact that Sony and Fox were doing okay with the Spider-Man and X-Men movies, I would not call either of those good movies. That is a personal thing. I do not like either of those lines. However, they were profitable and there were people who liked them. But the idea of a comic company making its own movies was absolute insanity at the time. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they were starting with Iron Man, who was, to the general public, like a blip on the radar, if anything.
Mostly an unknown.
Yeah, almost entirely unknown. And the entire comics fandom was like, they have lost their minds.
I've heard people say, oh, they should have started with Captain America. They should have done, I mean, there was a Hulk movie, but, you know, less said about Ang Lee's Hulk, the better.
Yeah.
So many other heroes that they had the rights to that they could have used before Iron Man.
Yeah, and then they said the three words that shut everybody up and got everybody on board. And this is your what has affectionately been called a Q colon moment from the Transformers, where like everybody was like, nope, you can't make a Transformers movie. And they're like, we got Peter Cullen. And everybody's like, okay, Transformers movie. Yeah, we're down for that. They said the three words that got everybody on board, which was Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, and at the time, Robert Downey Jr. was kind of on a downward spiral with his career.
Well, he was just pulling out of that spiral. He had done a couple of independent movies that were starting to get him back in the, okay, he's sober again. He's taking things more seriously. He is a more mature, kind of grown actor now. He's
a grown
not
person.
Yeah, he's not the party boy you remember. He's not constantly on cocaine and alcohol like he was.
Breaking into people's houses.
Yeah, breaking into people's houses and falling asleep in their beds. But the reason why that resonated so much in the fandom was that aforementioned storyline, Demon in a Bottle, which was the first time a comic book series ever dealt with the effects of long-term addiction on a character that you're supposed to empathize with. They had dealt with like drug PSAs before, where it was like, hey, we met this random junkie kid in the street, and then Spider-Man says, hey, kid, you shouldn't do drugs. And there was, you know, the little thing about who was it? Like, one of the sidekicks of one of the Marvel heroes had a short, like, one or two issue a thing where, like, he almost fell into drugs and then they were able to pull him out, and that was their, like, government-approved PSA to get around the comics code ban on dealing with drugs. Mm-hmm. But to have a member of the Avengers have a multi-issue story arc of, like, absolute blackout, drunk, total fall into the void of alcoholism, and have the Avengers have to, like, stage an intervention and get him into rehab and all that kind of stuff.
Which
that
is
was
perfect,
a,
for, perfect for Robert Downey Jr. It's a
yeah,
perfect
who had
reflection
just
on his real
been,
life.
Who had just been through all that, like, I don't know, 5 years before this movie was made, maybe?
Yeah.
And so that was the reason why the comic fans were like, you know, if you have to have somebody portray the kind of playboy with substance abuse problems who is still somehow charismatic and you want to be around him and you could buy him as some form of superhero, there was nobody else to play that part except Robert Downey Jr.
I agree.
The fact that his name was attached to it from the beginning was the only thing that rallied people behind it.
I mean, there were other people in consideration for Iron Man, one of them being Tom Cruise. I don't
that
know.
Would, yeah, I remember those rumors and the like, well, they're thinking about people to do it. Nobody would have taken Tom Cruise seriously in this part. And Tom Cruise is a good actor, despite his kind of personal issues. Tom Cruise is actually a good actor, and I respect his acting talent. But he could not have played this part the way Robert Downey Jr. played this part.
Agreed.
Because you do get that, like, you absolutely, there is something to be said for the baggage that the audience carried into this film. Of, we know what Robert Downey Jr. was. We had all of the, police mugshots. We had the perp walks. We had all of that in our brain.
Yeah. And considering, go ahead.
And when you're not supposed to really like Tony at the beginning of the movie, when you're supposed to consider him like a completely, you know, screw up playboy.
An a-hole.
Yeah, an a-hole. We bought that because honestly, that was what the public thought of Robert Downey Jr. at the time. Mm-hmm. we remembered his like weird smarmy statements in court. You know, we remember his kind of strange things he said to the press. We remember that entire spiral. And it also signaled to the fandom, the really hardcore fandom, like, maybe we're gonna get the darker side of Iron Man. Maybe mm-hmm. we're gonna get that, like, PTSD, demon in a bottle thing. We didn't entirely in the way
they
we would
like. They went more into that in Iron Man 2.
They did. But not as deeply as...
A lot of people wanted it.
I mean, not as deeply as I would have liked. But it did show that Marvel wanted to treat this with some sort of gravitas. And it's been a big, and it's still currently the big thing to debate in comic movies. How seriously do you take your comic movie?
Yeah.
As much as the Sony and Fox films prior to this did sort of take it a little more seriously.
But they were more, a little too much, because they were almost ashamed to them call them superhero movies. I mean, yeah, the X-Men were all dressed in black leather as opposed to their colorful costumes from the comic.
Well, would you have wanted yellow spandex?
Yeah.
Yes, actually. Yes, we wanted yellow spandex. That is exactly what we wanted. Hush. Yeah, I absolutely hated that. But they went a little too goofy with it.
Mm.
And then by the time you get to something like Dark Knight, which is what, like a year or two after this, I think?
About a year after.
Yeah. Oh, no, same release year.
Okay.
Okay. It started a couple of years before with Batman Begins, of course. But everybody thinks of Dark Knight as like the seminal in that series, which it is. But you know, we had just gotten the Batman one, and it was coming off of, you know, Tim Burton in the 80s gets a hold of Batman, and he completely goes the Frank Miller route with it. Like, it is dark, it is gritty, I have a weird voice, you know, it's like, and then in 05, Nolan does the same thing, but more. Like, we'll see, Tim Burton's problem was there were still comic book elements in his comic book film, and we want to make sure that there are none of those. And there is something weird about that dichotomy. I like the Nolan Batman films, I really do. But there is something weird about doing this, like, overly gritty realism and then dropping a dude in a cape in the middle of that.
Yeah.
There's a really weird, almost uncanny valley kind of thing it does to your brain where you're like, are they even going to mention how weird it is to have a dude dressed like a bat just wandering through this, like, ultra-realistic, gritty world?
But if you're not going to have him in the suit, why even call the movie Batman?
Yeah. But at the same time, you had the Spider-Man films and the X-Men films where it's like, they went a little too overboard. With the, you know, like, yes, we know this is goofy. We're going to call attention to how goofy it is at every single point we can.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't grounded enough. So there was a great concern over which of these two weird takes Iron Man was going to take. Casting somebody like Robert Downey Jr. suggested, even though he is a great comedic actor and was even before his downward spiral. I mean, he has always had comedic chops. You couldn't really see the Robert Downey Jr. of 2008 signing on for something goofy.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was into these kind of like weird art house, not weird, but these kind of like more like a dramatic art house films at the time. And so he was really establishing himself as like serious actor Robert Downey Jr. So you were thinking that it was going to come out like the dark and gritty Christopher Nolan version of Iron Man. And then that trailer hit.
Yep. I remember that. And I'm like, I'm on board for this. This is
cool.
Yeah,
the second the entire world saw that trailer, I think the whole world kind of came together in this beautiful unity of like, yes, this is a thing we want to see. This looks absolutely incredible. Because it was bright and colorful, you know, which is, I mean, the Marvel movies have a very specific look. And it started with Iron Man. I mean, but at the time, it didn't look like either extreme that we had gotten used to with comic book movies. It didn't look goofy and rubbery.
And it wasn't. This wasn't Red Brown in Captain America.
Yeah, I love me some Red Brown in Captain America, but you know, yeah, it was not that kind of goofy thing that they had done before. It wasn't even the level of goofy that you'd gotten in Spider-Man or X-Men. Mm-hmm. It seemed more realistic, but at the same time, it did have a sense of humor. Tony is cracking jokes throughout that entire original trailer. Mm-hmm. And it was bright, you know, it was shot outside during the day a lot of times, which is something that they like did not do in the Nolan films. It's always like in shadows and crazy, you know, heavy saturation and stuff. So, that trailer, I think, sold everybody on this is the movie you have to see.
Yeah, and they, you know, rather than doing, like we talked about before, rather than dulling the colors, they keep the gold and red on the Iron Man suit.
Yeah, and I really expected them to go with like a, well, no, it's a piece of military armor. Let's do it in a camouflage or something. You know, I really expected them to change the look.
Yeah.
But this is very faithful in a lot of ways to what the character looked like in the comics at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a more sleek, more modern technology take on it, but it was instantly recognizable as that is supposed to be the Iron Man suit.
Mm-hmm.
Which is great. You know, because, I mean, you show a picture from, like, the X-Men movies. They started showing pictures from that, and I'm like, this doesn't look at all like the X-Men. It just looks like people in generic black suits, and that one guy has claws. So I was not sold on X-Men from, like, the word go, but Iron Man looked like Iron Man. You know, you could have taken a still frame from almost any of the actual shots of the character in that original trailer and put it up on a poster in a comic book shop, and people would have been like, cool Iron Man poster. So yeah, that trailer was really make or break time for Marvel Studios as an emerging entity, because everybody was on pins and needles waiting for that thing to drop. And the second it dropped, we lost our minds.
Yep. So do you want to get into the other characters?
Yeah, I mean, because this thing had good casting all around, and a good selection of characters from the comics.
Yeah, so we talked about Iron Man, we talked about Robert Downey Jr. Let's talk about his counterpart, Terrence Howard as James Rhodey Rhodes.
Yeah, I really like Terrence Howard. I mean, he really did a good job. Actually, I don't wanna mock Terrence Howard, because we are, of course, more familiar now in the series with Don Cheadle. But Terrence Howard is a good actor, and he is good as Rhodey in this. I really thought he was going to go the distance for that.
There's a lot of reasons for that. Terrence Howard was actually the first actor to be signed for this movie, and he signed for this movie with these specific instructions. He was told, we're going to introduce you in this movie. If this movie is successful, we'll make you War Machine in the sequel. And he was all for that. Then it came down time for the sequel. He was the highest paid actor in this movie. Then Robert Downey Jr. was. Then he wanted his cut. You're fired.
Yeah. There's also a few other real life instances that happened between the making of the first movie and the making of the second movie.
Not to mention
some legal issues with Terrence Howard. I'm not going to discuss them. You can go look them up if you want, but it was not good and not really the sort of thing that Marvel Studios probably wanted sullying their newly shiny minted name.
And considering some recent comments that Terrence Howard made over the last few years, I think it was a good idea to let him go.
Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, that was a good idea. But when the second movie came around and they were like, well, he's not going to be in it, there was a small uproar from the type of people that say nothing must ever change.
I'm not a big fan of recasting, but Don Cheadle was better in the role. I'm going to say
he really was. And he was also a little more. He had that same kind of gravitas and yet playfulness. And he was almost the exact same age as Robert Downey Jr., whereas Terrence Howard is just a few years younger. And for some reason, when I was watching the movie again, I was like, you know, this feels more like a little brother dynamic to me than what we eventually get with Don Cheadle, which absolutely feels like two guys who are exactly on the same page and, you know, have seen some stuff together.
Yeah.
You know, you could absolutely, all those stories that he tells in the first movie of like, hey, remember when we're on spring break and the whatever? And I'm like, why would you have been going on spring break with people so much younger than you? Because Terrence Howard just reads so much younger than Robert Downey Jr., I think, in the first movie.
Mm.
Even though there's only like 4 years between them or something, it feels like a very large gap to me. Whereas when Don Cheadle came in, it immediately was like, you can absolutely see them in like a college together or, you know, getting drunk at the same time or whatever, which I liked. I do like that dynamic better.
The chemistry between Cheadle and Downey is a lot better than the chemistry between Downey and Howard.
Yeah, and considering all the real life stuff, it probably was a better choice for Marvel. But moving on, who else we got here?
Jeff Bridges is back.
We love us some Jeff Bridges, don't we?
This is the third movie we've reviewed with Jeff Bridges in it.
In the last month. Yeah.
As Obadiah Stane, a.k.a. Ironmonger.
Yeah, and Jeff Bridges is in a very undued role. We kind of pointed out in the Tron stuff that Tron showed Jeff Bridges was always going to end up as the dude. Mm-hmm. But here he is in a post-dude world, and he is the exact opposite of that character.
If the character in Tron had let the power go to his head and actually went all full corporate.
Yeah, if he had just gotten to the MCP and was like, yeah, I think taking over the world is a good idea. Let's join forces and become the great evil. Yeah, I think you would get Obadiah Stane. He is really good because you want to like Jeff Bridges. Mm-hmm. You want to like Jeff Bridges. Even with a shaved head and a weird beard, your instinct is to like Jeff Bridges as an actor, I think.
Yeah, Jeff Bridges actually shaved his head for this movie, which is weird.
Yeah, because he loves him his head of hair. let's say it. But he gives off that kind of fatherly warmth that we had gotten accustomed to from his previous roles. Like, you want to believe Obadiah Stane is just like, I mean, you do if you've never read the comics, but like
the father role, just, you know,
yeah,
start, if you're just, you know, Tony's father had passed away. Yeah. Tony's father had passed away and Obadiah kind of swooped in being the father figure to Tony, shaping him, grooming him to take over the company and whatnot. And this is sort of what the original, because this movie had been in development for quite a long time. The original idea for the villain was supposed to be Howard Stark himself, which putting Obadiah in this role now makes it a little bit more, make it a little bit more sense.
Yeah, I'm glad they didn't do that, because I kind of like retrospectively what they eventually did with Howard Stark. You know, we do eventually see him throughout the course of the MCU. And I like what they did with the character. I like how they worked it into the mythos. I like the actor they got to portray him, you know. But you've got to... I think the one thing, just before we kind of continue with characters, we mentioned it a little bit with Terrence Howard. Marvel was selling an amazing bag of goods here to the actors. Because their pitch was, we don't want to just make a movie. We want to make a whole universe. And honestly, they bring it up. I mean, right there at the end with Nick Fury, you've stepped into a larger universe. They were already telling people, if
there's more,
you go see this first movie, we've got 20 more planned behind it. We're ready to go. All you've got to do is just give us the money and show us you're interested. And for a film studio to just create a property out of almost nothing. I mean, comic book movies did not have a good record in 2008. You had like three that had done well.
And a lot that didn't.
And yeah, you know, dozens, for, yeah.
For every Dark Knight and X-Men and Spider-Man, you get Ghost Rider.
Or even kind of the goofiness of Blade. You know, we like it now looking back. But at the time, it was a joke. Yeah, it's nostalgia. At the time, it was a joke. Most of them were. Spawn tried it, and good grief, that's still a monstrosity. You know, even things like The Crow, again, cult hit, but at the time, nothing. You know? And even those were like the more darker, gritty, more realistic in some respects, especially with The Crow. But... you know, they're going to these actors and they're telling people like Robert Downey Jr. and Terrence Howard, you're not signing on for one movie. If this thing makes any profit at all, you're signing on for like 10.
Yeah.
With an option to renew. You know, telling him, you know, telling Terrence Howard, come be the kind of sidekick in this film and you'll get your own superhero in the next film.
There was even rumors of a War Machine movie with Terrence Howard at the time.
Yeah. I mean, you know, at the very least, he's going to be the second banana in a much larger role in the next film, but at most, he gets his own series.
Yeah.
So for the actors to step out on a limb like that and kind of agree to attach themselves to this unknown thing was, you know, a huge move. Jeff Bridges, not so much, because he was only in it for the one movie. You know, he gets the easy part. But if you're somebody like Robert Downey Jr. or, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow, who we'll get to in a second, you know, these are already big-name people who are suddenly hitching themselves to a complete unknown thing.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, let's go to Gwyneth Paltrow.
Gwyneth Paltrow as Virginia. Pepper Potts. A lot of people don't know her name is Virginia.
Yeah, you gotta be that comic book fan.
Why is she called Pepper? Because she has freckles, and Tony was teasing her about it. That's why she's called Pepper.
And because every Marvel character has to have a weird either pun or alliterative name. Really?
Yeah. So, Gwyneth Paltrow, at the time, was, again, Shakespeare in Love and all that.
Oscar winner.
Oscar winner. Nowadays, you think Gwyneth Paltrow, oh, she's doing homeopathic medicines and making candles that smell like certain parts of her body. But at the time, she was a star. She was a top level star.
She was probably the biggest name to be attached to this at the time.
Yeah.
Like, as far as box office draw, she was probably the biggest one. And for her to take, like, a side role, like Pepper Potts, which even in the comics, even in the comics, Pepper Potts is like the girlfriend for most of the comic run. So yeah, I mean, again, a huge gamble on her part as a, you know, Oscar winner Gwyneth Paltrow at the height of her career to be like, yeah, I'll take a side role to a guy whose career was just pulling out of a tailspin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so again, it's really impressive that they were able to sell all these names on a really bizarre concept here. At least by Hollywood standards at the time.
An unknown.
Nothing like this had ever been tried. You had a few franchises. Yeah. But there was nothing like this where it's like, no, Iron Man is not going to be the hero in every movie, but eventually in 10 years, we're going to get everybody together for something big. I mean, nothing like that had ever been tried.
Yeah, and the way they wrote Pepper in this movie is she's almost like, not necessarily the sidekick or the girlfriend, but she almost, in several scenes, is like, a counterpoint to Tony. It's like she's the responsible one. She's in cases she's almost just as smart, if not smarter, than Tony.
Yeah, what's your social security number? I did like the fact that they made her capable but still fun.
And what they and the role that she would end up playing in the later films, how, you know, Tony kind of steps down from the company and gives it to Pepper, which, again, that's a plot in the second movie where, you know, this person who her previous job was secretary is now the CEO of the company. And she ends up.
But honestly, has Tony made a decision in that company for, you know, 15 years by the time this movie starts? No.
That's all Obadiah.
Well, no, it's Pepper, because she comes to him and she's talking about business things, and his response is, no, you don't bring that to me. You just take care of it, and I sign something at the end.
Yeah.
It's made very clear that Pepper has been making decisions on behalf of Tony for years, and major business decisions, not just like, you know, charity events or what, but there's actual company business that she's been like, oh yeah, Tony told me to tell you, you know.
I trust your
but
judge.
That it's really her.
And you make it in the movie that can go, no, like there's no one else in the world he trusts more than Pepper.
Yeah.
Which,
I mean, you can't imagine him, the scene where he's changing out the arc reactors. You cannot imagine him trusting anybody else with that.
Now, he kind of plays it off, oh, she has small hands, she can fit in there. But right after, he pretty much says, I would have only trusted you to do this.
Yeah. So let's talk about a couple of the people who are kind of in the background of this one and eventually become huge in the future.
One of them being Jon Favreau as Happy Hogan, the director of this movie.
Yeah. And Jon Favreau as the director of this film was another huge gamble on the part of Marvel, because really the biggest movie he had directed prior to this was Elf with Will Ferrell.
Yeah.
That was his big directing credit. And for most of us, he was the weird dude that was in Swingers and had, like, you know, the side part in Daredevil. But, I mean, it wasn't like he was unknown, of course, to the Marvel fandom. Daredevil, a movie so bad that we didn't even bring it up until now. as a comic book film that got made in Marvel.
I only recognize the Netflix series until they do something else with the character.
Yeah, true. But, you know, it's so weird that to think that they're like, who should we get to pin all of our hopes and dreams for our new studio on? Oh, yeah, the guy who directed Elf.
Yeah.
And I'm not even saying Elf is a bad movie. But
that's a comedy. This is supposed to be an action movie.
Yeah, I mean, and the timing and the sense of cinematography and editing and scope that you have to apply to an action film, even a comedic action film like this one is, and what you do with a film like Elf, which is very much like a comedy with some slapstick bits in it, are so different skill sets that it's not even close, you know? The good thing is, though, is that he did have a bit of a sense with the kind of, at least, he also helped write Swingers, which was a huge cult classic and kind of very formative to me in the 90s when I saw it. It was one of those kind of independent films that a certain type of, like, weird film nut like I was kind of, you know, you're standing around in the video store and people are like, hey, have you seen this one? You know, it's really indie and really cool and not everybody gets it, you know, like,
yeah,
one of those. But the kind of dialogue flow in Swingers is very similar to what the writers of Iron Man did. It's that kind of witty repartee that we kind of expect now in Marvel films, but was not really a thing in comic book films.
Yeah.
You know, even in the early Spider-Man movies, Spider-Man was known in the comics for his witty comebacks, and it just does not come across in those films.
I mean,
All love to Tobey Maguire, but that does not come off as the witty, fast-talking Spider-Man from the
comic
time,
books. The only time it ever does is when he's fighting Macho Man Randy Savage. And that's not, yeah. And that's one scene.
And honestly, I think most of that is because Macho Man is a really good foil for stuff like that. He'd had decades of playing that character.
Mm-hmm.
John Favreau, another one where you're like, you're going to let that guy direct. But, you know, both his directing style, I mean, that shaped early Marvel.
Yeah.
What he did in Iron Man absolutely set the tone for the rest of the MCU.
Pretty much.
To the point that most of the directors are copying his style at this point.
A lot of the movies do have, you know, a special thanks to John Favreau during the credits because of that.
Yeah. And I mean, and then Taika Waititi goes off and does whatever he's doing. But most of them...
Yeah.
Most of them, you know, even to a bit, you know, by the time you get to the Avengers and you've got Joss Whedon at the helm, he's still playing into a style Jon Favreau set up. Mm-hmm. Just kind of on a grander scale. You know, what if that, but more? Yeah. Which is kind of Joss Whedon's wheelhouse there. Of, like, what if this thing, but more?
Yeah.
So Jon Favreau, and he puts himself in, because he was primarily known as an actor to this point, he puts himself in this, like, tiny little no-account, he's Happy Hogan,
He's a driver.
He's a driver, you know, I mean, yeah, he's known a little bit more, now, but, like, at the time, it's just like, oh, that guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Happy Hogan was not a big role, at least in this first film. Yeah.
And now, you know, you get to something like, Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yeah.
Or Spider-Man Far From Home. And Happy Hogan is like one of the central characters.
Yeah. It's amazing.
And possibly,
Uncle.
Yes, but possibly having some fun with super hot Aunt May. We also get the introduction of a couple of other characters that become huge later on, and I want to talk about
three more actors I want to talk about. Let's get to them in the order of how big their names are. So the first one, let's go with Paul Bettany as Jarvis. And he would later go on to play Vision in the other movies.
Yeah. But I will always, always remember him with fondness as Naked Chaucer. That's honestly what I knew Paul Bettany from. I'm not even going to lie. I had seen him in a bunch of stuff, but A Knight's Tale and Naked Chaucer, that's where I knew him from.
Yeah. This is definitely different than the Jarvis in the comic, because Jarvis in the comic was just a straight up butler, and the Jarvis in this movie is a sentient AI that kind of runs Tony's house for him and later his suits.
And at the time, this is at least what I have heard, and this may be apocryphal, I do not know, but I did hear Paul Bettany talking about it, so At the very least, if this is a lie, he's the one telling it. At the time, for the comic book fans, we just thought Jarvis was a fun play on the old Alfred the Butler thing and the Jarvis from the comics. You know, it's like, he's the old guy Butler, you know. But put into AI. And we thought at the time that Paul Bettany's voice was just going to be it. He's going to voice this AI character in the background of the movies, and that's going to be it. Paul Bettany, however, says that one of the things they got him roped into the part using was the idea that eventually this character was going to evolve into the Vision.
Hmm. So he already knew this going into this.
That's what he has claimed since. Like, after the reveal, after people found out about it, I did see an interview with him where the interviewer was like, so how did you react when they told you that this, like, bit part you were playing was going to turn into a major character? And he was like, well, actually, that's how they got me into the role. That may be, like, him retconning his own thing to make it sound like he knew, you know, more than he did. But I don't really know why he'd lie about that. It doesn't really seem his style. So I do think that probably turning Jarvis into Vision later, using him as the basis for Vision, was already in the back of their minds. If we get that far.
Yeah. Well, they're already at the time, they were already talking 10 movies ahead.
Yeah. So when you're already selling things like, you know, hey, come in, you're going to eventually be War Machine. Hey, Nick Fury, you're going to show up for, you know, we're going to get Samuel L. Jackson eventually, you know, to come in for 10 seconds at the end of this thing behind the credits, where that wasn't the thing, you guys. I don't know if you remember 2008, but the idea of a thing after the credits was not really a thing.
Yep.
In fact, I believe I was the only person in the movie theater, my father and I, because, you know, he always stays with me. But because of my, you know, weird completionist part of my brain that needs to read every last credit in the film, I do believe my father and I were the only people in the theater when that after credit scene hit. Because I think I saw it on opening night, and I don't even think that the rumor had gotten out yet that there was something after the credits.
Yeah. And now that's every Marvel movie. Every Marvel movie has the one at the end of the credits. There are still people who leave when the credits start, but most of the people, they're sitting in that seat and they're waiting to see what happens at the end of those credits.
Yeah. And let's talk about, since I've already brought it up, let's talk about the last two actors here who are both part of S.H.I.E.L.D. Let's start with...
You want to go with the TV star or the movie star?
Let's go with the movie star first, because I already name-dropped him.
So yeah, Samuel L. Jackson as Nick Fury, the director of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Oh, Samuel L. Jackson, you mother bee.
Shut your mouth!
I'm just talking about Sam Jackson.
I can dig it.
Yeah, I love me some Sam Jackson.
Yeah, I mean, again, no... an admitted comic book nerd in his own right, and he had already done Star Wars at that point, and already known for movies like Shaft, like Pulp Fiction. So, I mean, and countless other stuff. Sam Jackson will do anything, talking about, you know, monkey-loving planes and his money to fly a plane.
Okay, if you want to know what type of person Samuel L. Jackson is, I need to tell this story real quick. Okay.
Go ahead.
Snakes on a Plane arrived as a script on his desk titled Snakes on a Plane. And he went, you mother beep, I'm in. Okay? Like, I don't even think he made it through the whole script, according to his telling. He just saw the title Snakes on a Plane and was like, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. I'm totally down for that. Okay. So, then, when it was in filming, I think, at the beginning, somebody at the studio saw it and went, we are not making a movie called Frickin' Snakes on a Plane. That is the goofiest thing I have ever heard. Nobody's going to buy it. I've seen the dailies. It's like Samuel L. Jackson fighting with rubber snakes on a plane. What is this? And they wanted to change it to, like, Hawaiian Air Flight 815 or whatever the name of the flight is, okay? Mm-hmm. It was very generic. And Samuel Jackson marched into the studio head's office and went, oh, no, 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 no. I did not sign up for generic flight number whatever. I signed up for a movie called Snakes on a Mother Beepin' Plane. And you are going to give me a movie called Snakes on a Mother Beepin' Plane, or I walk out and do not finish this movie.
Because and that's why his wallet says BMF on it.
Yeah, and that's the kind of man he is. Like, he saw it and went, this is the craziest thing I've ever heard. I'm in. So, of all these actors, the fact that you'd walk up to Samuel L. Jackson and be like, comic book movie? You're in it for 10 seconds, but maybe in a decade, you're going to get like a full movie of your own. Samuel L. Jackson would have immediately been like, that's the craziest thing I've heard since Snakes on a Plane. I am in.
And of course, at the time, they had changed Nick Fury in some of the comic books to look like Sam Jackson. So this was already kind of perfect casting, as it were.
Yeah, the previous person to have played Nick Fury in a film was David Hasselhoff. Yeah, because he looked more like what comic Nick Fury looked like.
From what I heard, he had to be offered this role before they could offer it to anybody else. That's what I've heard.
David Hasselhoff?
Yes, he had to be
David offered. David Hasselhoff had right of refusal on Nick Fury.
That is what I've heard. I've always heard that rumor. That is, if I'm wrong, somebody tell me I'm wrong, but that is the rumor that I've heard, that he had to be offered the role first.
Wow, that is wild. I am so glad that if that is true, that he refused it.
Can you imagine David Hasselhoff in these movies?
You want to talk about gravitas. I mean, Samuel Jackson is a great comedic actor as well. But if he walks in with that deep voice and tells you he wants to talk to you about the Avengers Initiative, you are going to listen to him. David Hasselhoff walks in and it's like, hey, I want to tell you about the Avengers Initiative. You're like, oh yeah, did you bring your talking car with you and your like Speedos? Go away. Yeah. Go back to Germany where they like you. Because this ain't it, my friend. Yeah, so the fact that you would get... And Samuel Jackson at the time was a huge name, as he still is. You know, I mean, he'd already broken through and become maybe the second biggest name after Gwyneth Paltrow attached to this film.
Again, he's only in the movie for not even a minute.
Yeah, I mean, that first sequence, you're remembering that talk between Tony Stark and Nick Fury at the end of the credits as much longer than it is in reality. I guarantee you.
And it's a bigger part of the movie.
Yeah. I mean, that really is like 20 seconds of him going, I want to talk to you about the Avengers Initiative. And that's it. Like, that's all you get. So, yeah, the fact that he would come into this doesn't surprise me knowing what I know about him, but it surprised a lot of people at the time. Like, yeah. Really? He's going to come in for that? There has to be more to this. And there would eventually be more to it, but, you know, no. Let's talk about the big star to come out of this, the best part of this movie, and the person who absolutely probably did not believe this was going to go anywhere beyond this one part.
Clark Gregg as Agent Phil Coulson.
Yes. Yes, my love. Oh, Phil Coulson is absolutely the best thing in the MCU, and I will fight anybody who says so at a 6-foot distance with a javelin, because no. Okay, yeah, so, yeah, and watching this back for this rewatch, and Clark Gregg comes up on the screen all young and innocent and a guy in an ill-fitting suit, and you're just like, oh, you sweet baby. I wish I could go back to 2008 and tell you what you're in for, because none of us knew. None of us knew.
And this was not even supposed to be a main character. It's just a throwaway character, this character invented for this movie. And he kind of becomes a linchpin in the MCU. The bridging, the gap, the one that bridges the gap between the television shows and the movies.
Well, and honestly, he didn't even get the television show until after
Avengers.
He was linchpin in the movie. Yeah. He was, you know, the quote-unquote death of Phil Coulson was
the first death.
Yeah, the first death of Phil Coulson was absolutely the emotional core
of the Avengers.
Yeah.
You know, he's there, you know, in Iron Man 2. He's there in Thor. Reporting with the hammer.
He shows up in Thor, you know, guarding the hammer. Yeah. And by the time you see him in the Avengers, you know, he's already a known entity.
Yeah. And of course, they spin him off into the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. show. And that it's a whole other universe unto itself.
Related. I mean, related. You know. But the interesting thing is that this is a guy, and I've seen interviews with him where he talks about this. You know, Clark Gregg is a character actor. He's not a leading man. I mean, in 2008, he is definitely not a leading man. He is the character actor you don't really remember. You know, that was his niche in acting at the time. He had been on TV. He had been in New Adventures of Old Christine at the time, which was a TV show that was running at the time where he was opposite Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Mm-hmm. But even then, he was like her ex-husband that showed up now and then. Mm-hmm. He had done a couple of guest spots in like West Wing and Will and Grace. And so if you watched a lot of TV in the late 90s and early 2000s, you would remember him as, oh, that guy.
Yeah.
But he was not like, he was not a person, you know, and I am an absolute connoisseur of, oh, hey, that guy actors, you know, I mean, most of my favorite actors are people who are not household names. Even I had no idea who Clark Gregg was, other than when I saw him in the movie, I went like, oh yeah, it's that that TV guy. Okay. And I did not take any notice of Coulson in this first film at the time.
Yeah.
He was a throwaway.
Yeah.
He was just there to make sure that Obadiah Stane does not kill Pepper Potts in the office. That was his entire point in this movie. He needs to be a guy who's just there to set up the idea of S.H.I.E.L.D. that Nick Fury will later, you know, kind of punch home at the end of the film.
Yep.
And he needs to be another warm body in the room so that Obadiah Stane can't kill Pepper Potts in the office.
And what that character would evolve into. Like we said, he was the linchpin of phase one of the MCU.
And partially in phase two. I mean, by the time you get to Captain Marvel,
yeah,
thank God, he's like 90% of that movie.
Yeah.
De-aged.
De-aged
back to the 80s. Yeah. Like
him and,
like,
him and Sam Jackson.
Yeah. And then if you'd have told Clark Gregg in 2008, like, hey, this 15 minutes of screen time is going to get you a TV show in 10 years. Not even 10 years. Like,
you're gonna
what?
Be,
like
you're gonna 20, be playing
2012,
you're
2013.
You're going to be playing this character for roughly 15 years.
Yeah, easily. And honestly, with the de-aging thing now, is there any end to what they can put him in?
Honestly, if they decide to do, like, a Fantastic Four movie in the 80s, you can easily put Phil Coulson in there.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, pretty much, I think we set up that he joins S.H.I.E.L.D. in the 80s, but honestly, he's probably at the S.H.I.E.L.D. training in the 70s.
Probably.
You know, or perhaps he had, like, a military career before then. There's still a lot about Coulson's backstory we don't entirely know.
Yeah, prior to his run at S.H.I.E.L.D., we don't know what he did beforehand.
Yeah, so there's a little wiggle room of a good probably decade or more of his life where he is an adult that we haven't filled in, that they could just drop him into things if they said it in the 70s or 80s.
Yeah, you're the campaign one, campaigning for the Phil Coulson movie.
Oh my God, I would die for a Phil Coulson movie. Oh, yes. Here's the thing. Clark Gregg just showed up for a couple of episode run on The Conners, the Roseanne spinoff show that's on now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the happiest person on earth. Like, when he showed up, I didn't know he was going to be in the show. When he showed up, I lost my mind. I was just bouncing through my living room being like, it's Clark Gregg! It's Clark Gregg! And he absolutely was back in one of his, like, pre-MCU roles of like, oh, hey, that guy. Like, he's not a major part of the show. He is basically just a character actor that comes in and then leaves, you know. But it's so great because you're like, it's Clark Gregg, and he is my favorite thing in the entire world right now. Yes.
So yeah, so many of these characters would become so much of a big part of the MCU even now. Going into, you know, who knows? Maybe Clark Gregg will make a cameo in the Black Widow movie. Whenever
yeah,
that comes out.
That is absolutely, yeah, I mean, maybe December now, but that is absolutely possible. You know, because it is Black Widow's, you know, origin story. It is in the past somewhat.
Yeah, within the last 10 years, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, and so for him to show up in that would totally make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, we may get into Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. later. I mean, that is also a Disney property and owned and aired on ABC and stuff. And I'd love to get into that. But the idea, you know, of this character being pulled out of obscurity, basically. Because here's a hint. When you saw him in Iron Man 2, did you even really remember him?
Sort of. Like, he was the guy, we're S.H.I.E.L.D. now. He's the guy that kind of shortened that big, long name down to we're S.H.I.E.L.D.
2 years later, you were like, oh, they brought that guy back?
That guy back, yeah.
That guy's not important, you know?
Little did we know.
And then when he shows up in Thor a year later, and you're like, wait, is that guy really going to be, like, a thing?
Yeah.
And then he shows up in the Avengers, and you're like, oh, that guy is definitely a thing. And then he gets Jost, and you're like,
Wheaton got a Josh Wheaton.
Yeah, I dare you to stop Joss Whedon from Joss Whedoning. No, please. I don't dare you. I beg you. Please stop Joss Whedon from Joss Whedoning. If there is a good character in your film or TV series, Joss Whedon will murder them repeatedly in front of you while he makes you watch and laughs.
Yes.
Please stop doing that. So I don't mean to keep harping on it, but I'm gonna, cause it's my show and you're not gonna stop me. Phil Coulson is absolutely the greatest thing to come out of this whole thing. I love everything about him, and I love Clark Gregg, who, from all accounts, is such a sweetie.
I've always heard good things about the guy, even from the co-stars on the show. You know, he gets to make out with Ming-Na on a weekly basis on the show.
Everybody wants to do that, you know?
That's true.
Here's the thing, though. There was a series of Marvel one-shots.
Yes, I did want to talk
about that. I want to talk about these, because this is when we finally knew that Phil Coulson is absolutely going to be a thing. And it was between roughly Iron Man 2 and Thor, I think, was when these came out.
One was after Incredible Hulk and Iron Man 2, which was, there was two. There was The Consultant, and A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Thor's Hammer.
Yeah.
Between Iron Man 2, Thor, and Captain America were these two shorts.
Yeah, and The Consultant is all right. Yeah, okay, fine. But, you know, The Incredible Hulk did not really do as well as they had hoped. I like it. I know a lot of people don't. I absolutely respect what they did in that movie. I thought it showed a lot of promise. I am, in a way, sad Edward Norton didn't get to continue.
I am as well, but I think that it was for the best.
Yeah, no. It absolutely is for the best in retrospect, absolutely. But I respect that. So The Consultant is not really the one where you really fall in love with Phil Coulson. Let's talk about the big one.
Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Thor's Hammer.
This is when you suddenly realize Clark Gregg is an action star.
Yeah.
Up until this point, even in the films, Phil Coulson was the guy in the suit who wandered in and maybe shot a gun.
Yeah.
A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Thor's Hammer. If you've never seen it, it is online. I think it's on like YouTube or something. Go watch it. It's a couple of minutes long, and it is just Phil Coulson.
It shows you why he's a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent. It really does.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely shows you what he can do as a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent, and it took him from bureaucrat to action star in the span of about 3 minutes. It is just, he's in a 7-Eleven. Some robbers come in, you know, he's literally on his way to where they found Thor's hammer is the plot. Mm-hmm. You know, he's in like New Mexico or whatever. he's in a 7-Eleven, and it just happens to be the unlucky 7-Eleven that some robbers walk into. And they see unassuming little Clark Gregg, and they tell him, you know, to, like, give him his wallet and whatever. And he's like, no, I don't think I'm going to do that. And absolutely wipes the floor with these robbers in hand-to-hand combat.
Again.
Which is the first time we saw Coulson do hand-to-hand combat, I believe.
Yep. And that really did sell a lot of people on the idea of a S.H.I.E.L.D. television show.
Yeah, because a lot of people really liked the idea of Coulson. But I think we wanted to... I think we were like, okay, but who are they going to get to be like the action star? I get that Coulson's going to be like in the Nick Fury-ish kind of role of sitting behind a desk and he's the captain and maybe he'll grab a gun and go out into the field sometime. And then when we saw this, and by all accounts, Clark Gregg trained and trained and trained for this like 3-minute short. Mm-hmm. When we saw this, I think everybody was like, oh, Coulson's not the dude at the desk. Coulson is the dude you fear.
Yeah.
Okay.
He pretty much became a full on badass at that point.
Okay. Enough of me, like, you know,
Clark Gregg
trolling over, yeah, my weird Clark Gregg fetish. Sorry, Jennifer, I'm not like in, you know, trying to steal your husband, but I would if I could. Anyway. Call me Clark. We'll at least go have coffee. I'll be very nice and keep my hands to myself. But yeah, okay. So now that we're done with that, thank you for indulging me.
After 90 minutes of setting up. 90 minutes of setup.
Yeah, until the next movie. Okay, let's get into the actual plot, because this had to set up not just Iron Man as a character, but the entire idea of the greater MCU, where we would later find other superheroes.
Yeah, and this whole opening scene sets up so much. So we have Tony Stark, the CEO of Stark Industries, a weapons manufacturer for the U.S. military. And, you know, the opening scene itself, watching back now, is extremely dated. But we'll get into that. So the whole point
is...
And we'll get into that, but I want to set this up. So we have him and he's in Afghanistan. He's doing this big presentation of his new Jericho missile. When the group he's with is attacked by terrorists, and one of the missiles blows up in his face. His entire chest has shrapnel in it. He's captured by the terrorists. And they want him to make them the missile he was going to sell to the military. So for like 3 months, he's locked prisoner of war with this scientist Yensid, which we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah, because he really just is in this film. Really, yeah, I mean,
yeah. Sean Tube plays Yensid, and he kind of saves his life by hooking up an electromagnet to a car battery so the shrapnel doesn't infect his heart, and he dies. So he makes what would become his primary invention for the rest of the series, the arc reactor, to kind of keep the shrapnel out of his heart and kind of keep him alive. He eventually breaks out, thanks to Yensid, creates the Iron Man suit, and now, as we talked about earlier, he now knows that his weapons are now being used against innocent people, used by the enemies of the United States, which they kind of set this up in towards the beginning of the movie here, that he is a hardcore American. So having America's enemies have the weapons that he's been supplying to the U.S. military kind of gets on his nerves. But he also sees that what he believes to be peacemaking, like peacemakers that he's doing, is actually making it a lot worse for innocent people than it is anything else. And he wants to stop when he finally escapes. You know, he shuts it down. He shuts it down. You know, he shuts down the weapons manufacturing company. He wants to put more focus into the arc reactor. You know, try to benefit mankind instead of creating ways to destroy it. which Obadiah Stane doesn't like originally because, you know, they're a weapons company. Your father made the atomic bomb. We found out what more his father does later in the films. You know, like, your father would want us to continue doing what we do. Even Rhodey is disappointed in him, saying, you know, get your head in the game. You're a military company. Make stuff for the military. And eventually he makes the Iron Man suit for himself. And one of the first things he does is goes back to Afghanistan and destroys the weapons that the terrorists have. Which, not the best move to do, but considering he's one of those guys that, you know, why are we waiting around for bureaucracy and all this Garjon, whatever it is, talking about it. Let's just go and do it. And he does it because he's not part of any military. And he almost gets killed for it. But hey, what can you do?
Yeah. I kind of want to say that I like how much, before we get into what he eventually does with the technology.
Yeah.
I like how much of the character was modernized, of course, mm-hmm. but very, very much grounded in the original idea that sparked Iron Man in the comics.
Yeah, rather than being in Vietnam, it's in Afghanistan, which, yeah, that would be a more modern war. And he's still a playboy. He still kind of doesn't really think about anyone other than himself until he, like you said earlier, sees it firsthand what's going on. Then he kind of wakes up and decides to become a better person.
Yeah, and one of the things that Stan Lee said about the creation of this character originally was that he wanted to take everything the youth in the 60s hated. And somehow, he said it was a dare to himself, somehow take everything that his readership hated and turn that eventually into a hero. So what did the youth of the 60s hate?
The war.
They hated the war, but they also hated capitalism. They did. I mean, in a lot of ways. You know, when Stane says in this film, oh, we just created the arc reactor so the hippies would shut up. Yeah, these were the hippies that Stan Lee was writing for when he created the character. Yeah. You know, there was that big undercurrent of the idea of the military-industrial complex and what it was doing to the youth of America. The youth at the time who were terrified of getting drafted into the war, of seeing their brothers and fathers and uncles and friends die in a cause that a lot, at least the youth of the country, had started to turn against.
Yeah, and you look at it today, the more things change, the more things stay the same.
Yeah, which is exactly where we were at in 2008 in the war in Afghanistan. You know, right after 9/11, I think a lot of people of all ages were very much, you know, suit up and get in the saddle and get over there and get us some terrorists. Mm-hmm. But by 2008, we were going, you know, we've been here for a while. Yep. And we're hearing some things we don't like. And a whole bunch of people are seeming to get really rich over the fact that we're not leaving.
Yep.
And it was primarily the younger demographic and the demographic that the MCU was going to be targeting. I mean, they were trying to get that kind of, like, primarily teenage, primarily male, or slightly older people with a bit of nostalgia for the character. Mm-hmm. But the target demographic they were going for was sort of teenage boys.
Yeah.
And teenage boys who were looking at this suddenly never-ending war going, is it going to get worse? Am I going to, do I want to go into the military? You know, like maybe my family served and now I'm wondering, you know? So it was a almost precise parallel of what was going on when the character was created. So I know that a lot of people at the time, myself included, were wondering why Marvel Studios picked a second stringer that most people had forgotten about. Because honestly, after the emotions around the Vietnam War kind of cooled a little bit for the target readership, Iron Man really kind of fell off the radar for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, I think somebody at Marvel Studios realized we've got the exact same sentiment going now. The idea of this war that's gone on too long, that we may have been lied to get into, that we're worried about the people who are over there, and now there is a certain type of person who's getting very rich over all this suffering and death and collateral damage, as Obadiah Stane keeps saying. And so I think it was really smart of them to pull this character out of mothballs, basically, and reintroduce him, because this is where the zeitgeist had returned to, I think.
Yeah, and it worked because Iron Man is now considered one of the top tier superheroes of all time.
Yeah, and it revived him in the comics as well, you know? Yeah. So I like the fact that, you know, props to whoever realized that at the time that this was the way to go. And you really did not have to change his basic storyline a lot. You could update it a little bit, but the idea that he was, you know, an orphaned industrialist who ran a weapons manufacturing company, got kidnapped by the enemy, and got shown the true horror that
of war, pretty much.
Yeah, of not only of war, but of the true horror that his family fortune was built on.
Yeah.
You know, that he was a product of blood money in a very literal sense.
Yeah.
You know, the only reason he was able to be the playboy billionaire is because a lot of people had died. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great that they brought the character back for that and that they built the plot around that. Because, you know, at other points in time, they would have changed it.
Yeah.
They would have backed off the tenseness of this. The only thing I'm going to fault them for is a thing I have to fault all of Hollywood for. This is not just the Iron Man movies. If you want to show U.S. military technology in a film, you know, props and stuff like that, you know, have those fighter planes in the background and things, mm-hmm. you have to run your script by the Pentagon. And the Pentagon has to sign off on whether or not they think your script portrays the American military in a light they deem pleasing.
Well, that's also to get permission to use that. And then you get extra funding for your film from the military.
Oh, yeah. You get tax incentives. You get to use, you know, military personnel as props in the back of your film. You know, there's a lot of reasons why almost every Hollywood film that ever has to deal with anything related to the military, they have to go through this. But the Pentagon does get to say yes or no based on what they find in your script. So if I have one problem with this, is that in a comic sense, they were able to question, I think, the role of the military in Vietnam a little more. Mm-hmm. In a film sense, we never once question a single decision by the American military. The problem is that the big bombs ended up in the wrong hands.
Yeah, that's the whole point. That was Tony, and even they say that, that Tony even said that he wants his, he doesn't want any of his weapons getting in the wrong hands. It's not that the U.S. was doing this, that, and the other. It was just that as long as the U.S. is doing it, it's okay.
There's never a discussion of collateral damage that America may have caused. Although it's kind of suggested. There is a suggestion that you know, that his good buddy there in the cave that saves his life, you know, when he's talking to Jensen. Jensen already says, you know, or at least, you know, when he's dying, he says his family's already dead. His village had been destroyed already. And we get the feeling that his village probably wasn't destroyed by the Ten Rings.
No. I wouldn't doubt that.
Yeah, there.
But they can't be specific.
It's left ambiguous. It's left ambiguous in the actual film. But, yeah, there is a feeling hidden in there that they can't say outright that it might have been collateral damage that the U.S. military caused, or at least the allies of the U.S. military caused, rather than the Ten Rings.
So let's kind of backtrack here. I want to talk about that opening scene, and like I said, how this movie dates itself.
Yeah, a little bit.
CD player. References to Maxim magazine. A digital camera and a reference to MySpace. 2008.
Yeah, MySpace. That was, I laughed because I had forgotten about that when he says, I better not see this on your MySpace.
Like, this is so, and it's also in that era where it wasn't like digital phones, smartphones as we know them, didn't really exist or were not widely widely available as they are now. As you see him, Tony, have a video conference with a video call with Obadiah as he's in his bed. Like, that's a normal thing now, but in 2008, that was fantastical. Unthinkable.
Yeah, and every phone they use is really way bigger than you remember.
Yeah.
Looking at it now and you're like, oh wow, that is such a huge phone, and then you're thinking, you know, I mean, the phone I had then was
in 2008
was probably larger than that, you know. And a BlackBerry, you know.
Yeah.
but yeah, so, you know, they try to mix the fantastical with a kind of grounded realism and also product placement. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. That is absolutely product placement.
Yeah.
But even when you're talking about the people who would have the best of technology, it's still amazing how far technology has come in that time. I mean,
Rhodey has a flip phone in this movie.
Yeah. And it's absolutely, you're like, wow, Rhodey's phone is kind of the hotness, you know?
Yeah, in 2008, in 2008, yeah.
So, yeah.
Of course, a big reference is, something that will become a big reference later is Tony Stark, as soon as he gets back into America, first thing he wants is a cheeseburger.
Yeah, that... It is impressive how long that reference has lasted.
Yeah, the fact that that was a callback in Endgame is like, if you got it, you got it. If you didn't get it, you don't need to.
Yeah. But, you know, it's realistic, though. I've got to give these movies and the MCU in general credit for doing what not a lot of films really did, which is, even though they tried to keep a lighter tone for the most part, they also did try to show that, you know, Tony was fundamentally changed in some very deep and dark ways.
And they would explore more in the other two Iron Man movies.
Yeah, of his, but it starts here.
Yeah, he pretty much has PTSD after this incident.
And the thing is that Obadiah Stane uses it against him. You know, like, oh, I'm going to tell the board you've got PTSD. But the thing is it's valid, and he's not wrong. he's wrong in what he does with that information and the exploitation of that information. Yeah. But if you spent 3 years in a cave with a gun to your head, hooked up to a car battery.
3 months.
3 months, excuse me. Yeah, 3 months.
Still, that's, might as well be 3 years.
You're not going to recover from that easily.
People have been in their house now 2 months, and they feel like it's a million years.
Yeah, I mean, there are people now who are going through such a traumatic, you know, thing. And shout out to all of you, because we're right there with you.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't left my house for longer than like 45 minutes in weeks, because I am not considered an essential worker. Unfortunately, can work from home. I know it's different for you. Yes, because you are.
My real life, I am an essential worker.
And thank you for that. You know, I mean, even for those of us right now, we're getting like the most cushy taste of that.
Yeah.
And a lot of us are having problems with it, and that's fine. But I did like these movies for not entirely glossing over that. I know in the first movie they didn't really want to dive into it because we were not used to that. Even in Batman Begins, you know, which we had gotten before this, it was darker in tone, and they didn't quite go as deep into it as they would in Dark Knight with Bruce Wayne's trauma from what he had to deal with.
Yeah, Bruce Wayne had his parents murdered in front of him when he was 8 years old. That screws you up.
Yeah. And, you know, and they deal a lot with Tony's darker, you know, parts of his past. Even in this first movie, they talk about the fact that he lost his parents. And there is that moment at the press conference when he comes back about, I didn't get to say goodbye. I always wanted to ask questions, you know.
And they would call back to this in Civil War.
Yeah. When you find out more about what caused that car crash. But even here, just like, oh, it was an accident, that still comes with a lot of baggage. And it shows you, I think I love this movie most for the way it portrays the fact that Tony was already going through a trauma response and a bad coping strategy for it.
This party.
Yeah, he had that trauma from his childhood. And because he had access to the money, he just bought away and partied away all of his emotions. To the point that Pepper questions if he has a heart. You know, which is what makes the arc reactor statue so meaningful.
Yep.
Is that you see that because of the horribleness of the way he lost his parents, that he's never let anybody get close to him. He doesn't want to show emotion. And he gets... Yeah, go ahead.
Like I said, he's with all of these models and whatnot, and the hot reporter, and it's just a one-night thing. It never really goes past that. It's not even until Pepper that he actually has a long-term relationship.
Yeah, for the first time in his life, you know, and he's already, what, in his, like, mid to late 40s, I think he's supposed to be in these films, so...
Yeah.
Yeah. but he already has that bad trauma response, and then he goes through an even, you know, worse trauma, faces his own death,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly realizes, like, you know, man, I gotta be better than this.
And even they explain it more in other films that it's a lot also combined with survivor's guilt. There's even a part where he says, I should be dead.
Yeah, and he says that in the movie. Like, I should have never lived unless there is a point to it. He needs it to have a point. He needs to know why he got out of that cave and Jensen didn't.
Yep. He made a point for himself. You know, if I'm going to keep on living, I'm going to live for a reason.
Yeah, and... But, you know, there is a little bit that kind of got cut out. It's in a deleted scene on Disney Plus if you want to go watch it. But there is a little bit of an extended bit in the plane ride to Afghanistan when the stewardesses are dancing and all that. and he and Rhodey are drunk, that Rhodey tells him, like, you gotta live a better life. You gotta be a better person than this. And for Rhodey, that's being in the military. It's devoting himself to a cause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to let someone know, we did watch this on Disney Plus, which makes the Paramount logo in the movie all that more stranger.
Yeah, it's really weird to see, like, Disney Plus followed immediately by Paramount logo. it's going to get a little weirder, I think, whenever we get into, like, a Fox thing or something, you know.
We reviewed a Simpsons movie.
Yeah, the Simpsons movie, that's going to be weird. But, yeah, so I like the fact that they did try to go a little realistic with this. Without making it too dark. You don't want this movie to be, like, too dark.
Also not too preachy.
Yeah, not too preachy. Although we are dealing with dark and kind of preachy subjects. I mean, we are talking about, you know, war profiteering. We are talking about, quote-unquote, collateral damage, which is, you know, murder, civilian deaths, civilian casualties. You know, we are talking about the choices that the military makes as a whole.
And you see in this film, collateral damage, Obadiah is okay with that as long as he makes money. But Tony
isn't.
And
he's okay with it on American soil.
Yeah.
You know, he refers to, like, Pepper as collateral damage. He refers to the people in L.A. as collateral damage.
Yeah.
Which is not something we're used to seeing an American businessman saying outright necessarily.
Yeah.
Especially
usually in these kind of films, that kind of character is played by a non-American or played as non-American.
Yeah, you would have expected that the Ten Rings people would have been the ones to say, like, well, you know, collateral damage over there, collateral damage over here, it's all the same, isn't it, Mr. Stane?
Yeah,
but the fact that we kind of, you know, for the first half of the movie, you're led to think that the Ten Rings is really, which is portrayed initially as just a Middle Eastern / Asian terrorist group.
And of course, the Ten Rings is a reference to the character of the Mandarin, which we'll get into when we eventually get to Iron Man 3.
Yeah. However, but in this first thing, if you don't know anything about the comics, all the movie portrays it as is this is a Middle Eastern / Asian terrorist group.
Yeah. Well, they say that, or as Jens had said, it's a little bit of everybody. They have members of pretty much any non-American country. Any non-American country pretty much has members in the Ten Rings.
Yeah, and...
Romanian, and Russian, and Chinese.
Yeah, it's,
you know,
mostly kind of Eastern Bloc and Middle Eastern Asian kind of groups. It's there's no really, like, South American groups or anything that he really mentions, you know, or no Cubans. I don't think he mentions, though, you know. It's interesting to me that they build it up. Well, unless you speak, what is it, Farsi or Urdu? I can't remember what they're speaking at the beginning of the movie. Mm. But in that first scene where Tony Stark is taken, they just lay out the whole plot. So if you speak that language, you knew immediately that Stane was the bad guy, that they were working for him. You know, that was not a... Yeah, there's a whole section of the world that was not a...
Yeah. That scene was not subtitled for a reason. And it's the only scene in Afghanistan that isn't subtitled. And it's, again, that's because of what we would find out later.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that I always assumed, because I do not speak any of those languages used, I always assumed that they used, like, a shortened version of what Pepper eventually watches and gets translated.
Mm-hmm.
That they were watching a thing of, like, you know, they had filmed a kind of PR version that they sent out to the media, maybe. Like, oh, we've got your Tony Stark. We'll kill him if you don't pay. So that Obadiah Stane could keep, plausible deniability.
Yeah.
Like, oh, but we were trying to figure out whether or not that we should deal with terrorists, and you know, we were trying to get the money together, and then they killed my poor friend Tony before we could make the trade.
Yeah.
So I just assumed that that was the decoy video that we see them filming at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Because it is filmed like one of those propaganda videos we got so used to seeing at the time.
Yep.
Which makes it weirder if they're filming just that video just for the purpose of contacting Obadiah Stane. Why are all their faces hidden? Why are they, you know, like, why are they just not...
That's for us. That's not for Stane. First. That's for us.
Yeah. But I think if they'd have said there were two videos and Pepper found the one that was not released to the public, I think that would have been a little more understandable. And also, yeah, it wouldn't have ruined the surprise for the people who actually do speak the languages in question.
Yeah. So, we can skip ahead there. You know, the translation is pretty much, Mr. Stane, you never told us the person we were kidnapping was the great Tony Stark, and, you know, things just changed for it. And
I wonder why he was considered the great Tony Stark.
Because of the military weapons. Because of the weapons. Because he created these great weapons of death.
But here's the thing, though. A lot of people don't necessarily believe that once you get to the point that Tony Stark was getting, and especially if you're the person who inherited a company, you know, if say, you know, a child of Bill Gates or something inherited Microsoft, I'm not sure everybody would believe that that child was automatically a tech genius unless they had specifically come up with some idea themselves.
Well, that's part of the award presentation early in the movie to let the audience know that, you know, he graduated MIT at 17. He created all of these he revolutionized technology. He brought the company out of the brink with his inventions and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, all right. You know, I don't know. I'm just always like, I'm so used to being sold a bill of goods about these people in the real world of like, you know, I mean, Bill Gates knows something about computers, but he didn't invent Windows. Mm-hmm. Some other people in, you know, a basement invented Windows and he just put his name on it. You know, it's not that he doesn't know anything about computers, but he didn't actually sit down and code all that himself. Mm-hmm. You know, so I always thought that we were supposed to think initially in the movie, not after we see him in the cave doing it with his own hands. Mm-hmm. But initially in the movie, I think we were supposed to think that everybody thought of him as like, oh yeah, Tony Stark invented that. You know, when you're thinking like everybody just thinks it's like a group of nerds in a basement somewhere who get paid far too little and then Tony Stark puts his name on it.
Yeah.
I always thought that the big reveal was supposed to be in the film that like Tony Stark actually is a capable human being. Because there is nothing in the first part of the movie to lead us to the idea that he knows anything about anything.
Now, he's just this rich kid who just puts his name on everything and
doesn't
really invent it. He just takes the credit for it. And we find out in the cave that, yeah, he actually does have engineering knowledge. And we see in his garage where he's tinkering with the cars and all that.
Yeah, and Stane even seems to be surprised by what Tony could do. You know, that's the whole point of In a Cave with a Box of Scraps.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, no, I have actual, like, you know, educated nerds. You're not just, like, some rich dude that's drunk all the time. How can you not do the thing he did with a bunch of substandard parts and no equipment? So I don't even think Stane thought that Tony is as smart and capable as Tony is.
Maybe Tony didn't even think of himself until he had a gun pointed to his head.
I mean, that's true. But I do wonder if like, you know, the history of the company before that we never really get to see was Tony just kind of wandering through and being like, hey, what if you coded this to do that? Okay, get on it. And then just left the room. And then people were like, oh yeah, Tony's a genius. He told us to code this into that, you know.
Or it could be like, oh, we never thought of it that way. Oh, damn, the kid's right.
Yeah, and there is some use for that, but I don't think we were ever supposed to think that anybody considered Tony like a hands-on kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong on that, but that was always my read in the film, is that everybody was surprised that Tony had this in him.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I think it's interesting. Yes, Jensen's great kind of surgical move. You know, bravo to Jensen.
Yeah, I mean, he does take out a majority of the shrapnel. He's giving Tony the little test tube with all the little shrapnel in it. But, you know, using the magnet to push it away from his heart. Again, smart move, and probably not something any other surgeon could have thought of.
Maybe Stephen Strange, but he's not in this yet.
Not yet. He's still doing open-heart surgery down the street in Manhattan.
Yeah, but I like the idea that Jensen had a life before. You know, he wasn't some dude from some backwater. You know, a lot of Americans are thinking like, oh, Afghanistan, you know, and even Stane says it like, oh, technology is never really your thing. This guy is able to rig up a life-saving medical device also in a cave with a box of scraps and a car battery.
And you could have said that if Jensen had survived and Tony didn't, it would have been a much different movie.
Yeah, because nobody would have given him a chance. You know, he would have just been yet another refugee.
Yep.
We know that at some point in his previous life, Jensen was at a conference with Tony.
We see that in Iron Man 3.
Yeah, and but he
the fact that they called back to that. The fact that Iron Man 3 called back to that,
which is great. I mean, I love the MCU for how much it goes back to previous films, and a throwaway line like Jensen saying, I met you at a conference once, later becomes the central part to something later on. Yeah. And also kind of figuring out like how Jensen probably got involved with the Ten Rings, you know, I mean, how he would have come to their attention.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the idea that we see the counterpart of Tony. Jensen seems just as capable and intelligent as Tony, but he's the guy that got stuck in the wrong part of the world.
Yep.
In the wrong economic class, in the wrong situation. And he's the one that ends up paying the price for it. Which is, again, not really called into stark relief in the film for the reasons I've mentioned before, but it is there if you're paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
Which I like that they did what they could.
So yeah, let's kind of move forward from the Afghanistan part. I think we stayed on that part a little too long.
But it is the cornerstone of the MCU.
True.
Rest of the movie is kind of fluff on top of that.
I mean, yeah, you can take that whole Afghanistan part of the movie, and you've got like five or six movies that breach out just from that one part of the movie.
Yeah, and honestly, there's not as much in the latter half, I guess, of the movie that is quite as impactful as the stuff that happens in Afghanistan in this one. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he gets back, he gets his cheeseburger, he does the announcement that I want to be a better guy, I don't want to make weapons anymore, the stocks immediately tank.
We get another reference to a show that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Mad Money on MSNBC.
But, you know, I do like the fact that he comes back with a mission.
Yeah.
At least in some part. And that he wants to help.
He wants to be a better person.
But he doesn't even fully get that until he finds out about the attack on Jensen's hometown.
Yeah. And again, we get the reporter, the same reporter that Tony slept with earlier in the movie, who ends up holding a grudge against him for the rest of the film because it was a one-night stand.
Yeah. Which, fair. I mean, honestly, in a little bit, if I woke up the morning after meeting somebody interesting and important and there was just, like, Pepper Pot standing there being like, oh, good, I get to take out the garbage. Goodbye. I think I would hold a grudge. I think that's fair that she holds a grudge. But I think that's more on Pepper than Tony, honestly.
Yeah.
Okay. But, yeah, but it's that, you know, the reporter comes to him with the physical proof that not only is his weaponry still being used to hurt innocent people, but specifically the man who saved his life, you know, that guy's friends and family in his hometown.
Yeah, and this is where, you know, he starts actually confront Obadiah about it. Like, why are we selling our weapons to terrorists? And it's like, you know, it's okay. You know, it's all a game. We'll make money off of it, blah, blah, blah. And then we finally get is this part where we get the reveal that Obadiah was the one that outed Tony from the company?
Yep.
And that was it's another part of the movie. Oh yeah, the board elected to out you out of the company. You can't make a decision anymore. And then Obadiah comes and saying, yeah, it was me. I led that deal because we couldn't trust you anymore because we're a weapons company. We got to keep making weapons and you don't want to make weapons anymore. Therefore, you're not part of the company anymore.
Yeah. But you know what I love is that in the interim between this scene right here when he finds out about Gomera, mm-hmm. and the point when he comes back home initially, mm-hmm. he's been working on the Iron Man suit. We get all these montages of him working on the Iron Man suit and him going to Rhodey and saying, hey, I'm working on a project and I want you to come look at it. I am not going to sell it to the military. But he doesn't seem to know what to do with it yet.
Yeah. He even says, you know, what about the pilot without the plane?
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, the unsung character in that whole thing, the fire extinguisher robot.
Yes, the fire extinguisher robot is the best. I love that thing. Second only to Phil Coulson in this movie. But we see him tinkering around with it. And goofing off with it. But I think that he doesn't even know what he's going to do with it yet.
No, he knows he made it but that's all on it. All that's on his mind. That's how he escaped the terrorists. You know, that's so now that he created it. Yeah, keep working. That's the way to move past this experience. Made it. I have to make it better.
Yeah. And again, you know, he's given one bad trauma response for another. Trauma response was partying, and now it's work.
Yeah, and that goes through the entire trilogy of Iron Man movies up until the end. That's his coping mechanism, is just working on these suits.
Yeah, to the point where he eventually has like 50 of them, you know, just hanging out in his basement, which proves useful later, but, you know... It's maybe not the most healthy mechanism at the beginning.
Buy all the toys, kids!
Yeah, buy all the toys, kids, or adults. It's not kids. It's us. It's us. Yeah. But, okay, so it is interesting that the Gomera is the point where he goes, I know what to do with this suit now. I know who I have to be. Because initially, what does he do? He hears this news, he goes home, he tinkers with the suit while he's drinking and watching the news. Mm-hmm. And it's only until the reporter says, like, who's going to help these people, that he finally comes to the decision, I am. Nobody else is going to do it. I have to be the one.
Yeah, the military isn't going to do it. Again, that's military jargon. You know, we have to go through, there are channels to go through before we can go in there. Yeah. With Tony not being part of any military, he just goes wherever he wants.
But you know what? The stated reason the military held back is what I'm actually going to be okay with. They were using human shields.
Yeah.
Which is the military's stated reason for why they had not gotten the go-ahead. There were too many potential civilian casualties.
Too many civilians in the area.
Tony doesn't think about that, which is probably a thing we can fault him on. It turns out all right. We don't actually see him causing anything, but they will bring that back for Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Avengers eventually are a part of something that causes civilian casualties.
Mm-hmm.
And it is recklessness like Tony starts in this film of not thinking about it. You know, there's a thing that needs to be done. I'm going to go in and do the thing, and I'm not going to entirely think it through because I am too caught up in my own sense of power. Which, yeah. I respect the Marvel movies for actually getting into and being a big plot point. Is that what do you do? How do you stay ethical when you have all this power? Which we usually see done in the supervillain idea.
Yeah.
But I like that they bring it in for their heroes, too, that the heroes have to think about the consequences of their actions.
And that was great, but how they did it in Civil War. And yeah, you kind of see it here where, you know, he kind of has to lower the repulsor when he sees a human shield. And yeah, it works out with the shoulder missiles and all that. But yeah, Tony doesn't think things through it.
Yeah. But all it would
Obadiah actually says it in the movie. Shoot, fire, aim.
Yeah. You know, even with the, like, heads-up display and the targeting missiles and everything, all it would have taken was, you know, one of those civilians to twitch at the wrong time, and they would have been in the line of fire.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, you can, and we do frequently, as a society, debate... is that a chance that is worth taking? But I like these movies for delving into that somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I like this scene. I mean, it's got all the cool things of, you know, like, oh look, he fires and then walks away from the explosion because that's what cool people do. But I like this scene for showing the moment where Tony realizes, like, nobody else is going to save them, so maybe it should be me.
Yeah. No one can save them at that point, because, like you said, the military can't go in there because of too many civilians.
Yeah, and honestly, the military in this film does not have the ability that Tony does to be, like, the one-man surgical unit.
Which, again, goes into the second movie, where the military wants the Iron Man suit for this reason, and he's saying, no, I will never sell to the military again.
Yeah. But, you know, we get that point where he has decided now, full scale, I'm going to be a hero.
Yeah.
And Pepper, you know, he wants Pepper to help him get the dirt on the company. He doesn't realize it's Stain specifically yet. He just wants to see the shipping manifest to prove they've been selling to the other side.
Yeah.
And wants Pepper to help him, and Pepper's response is, no, you haven't thought this through. You're going to get yourself killed, and I'm not going to help you do that.
Yep.
Which I love. That she is the voice of reason here of, you know, Tony, it worked out this time. This time. But there are consequences here you are not thinking about.
Yeah, when Pepper sees the bullet holes in the armor, she freaks out.
Rightfully so, yeah.
Yeah.
But I... She does end up eventually helping him because she realizes he's not going to be talked out of this.
Yeah.
So at this point, Pepper has gone into a damage mitigation stance. You know, maybe he'll drop it if I get the information.
You can tell that's not her first rodeo with him in that mindset.
Yeah, it's just that all of a sudden it's gone from, like, I want to buy a bunch of weird art to I'm doing something that could get me killed.
Yeah.
And not just him, but other people. I mean, he went into an active war zone where there were civilians. So, you know, she does the thing about getting thing, discovers that it's Stain, gets caught by Stain, gets saved by the wonderful, wonderful Phils Coulson being in the right place at the right time. And it leads us to the big climactic battle between the suit Stain has been building, Ironmonger, although never specifically named that in the movie. Stain does have a line. Does have a line of, we are Ironmongers. But the fact that the suit is called Ironmonger is never specifically mentioned in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we get the big climactic battle of, you know, here's Tony. Do we get really a callback to the little paralyzing device that Stain is using? I can't remember if that shows back up in the series.
I don't think so. He used this twice, you know, once on the terrorist leader and once on Tony. Oh, yeah, and I forgot about that, you know, Stain pretty much has military people kill up terrorists but they're all paralyzed.
Yeah, which is interesting. And it makes you think that's the last we're going to see of the Ten Rings.
Oh, no.
When we were first watching this movie, everybody immediately was like, that is a major organization, and the Mandarin is, like, really huge in the comic books, and you're just going to wipe out the entire Ten Rings organization.
Just wait till we get to Shang-Chi. Till we get to Shang-Chi. 2021, 2022, whenever they decide to release that.
Yeah. But, you know, Stain breaks into his house somehow.
Well, he's a known entity. Jarvis would just let him in.
Maybe. I don't know. But, you know, he uses this little paralyzing button, which at this point is only reminding me of Westworld, because that little button that can shut things down, it's like a huge thing in Westworld right now. Interesting thing, I did not remember that Ramin Djawadi, who is the, apologies if I mispronounced that, but I think I got it right, who is the now known as the music guru for Game of Thrones and Westworld, and, you know, is massive, that he was also the music person for this one.
Yep.
Before a lot of people really knew who he was, and this is not the style we have come to expect from him. But, yeah, interesting thing that they're basically using a thing that is now, like, the major plot point in the current season 3 of Westworld. Anyway, but, yeah, you know, Stain gets mad because they can't build what Tony Stark builds in a cave with a box of scraps.
Yeah, if you can't build it, steal it.
Yeah, so he just decides to go rip the one out of Tony's chest. He wants Tony dead anyway, might as well do it yourself, right?
Yep. And, you know, they could have easily, you know, Stark Industries could have easily reverse engineered that little thing.
Yeah. And Pepper ends up saving Tony's life in a roundabout way, because Tony had told her to destroy the original miniature arc reactor. He is not nostalgic. He doesn't
That would also change. That would also change in later films.
As we, that, you know, he becomes nostalgic and keeps things?
Well, he made an entire VR system just to get over his parents' death.
Well, yeah. But, you know, he wants her to destroy it. It's bad memories, you know? Yeah. And Pepper doesn't. She realizes that it is an important part of Tony's history.
She has it engraved. You know, proof that Tony Stark has a heart. Again, yeah. Which again gets called back in Endgame.
I mean, yeah, all over and over again. I mean, that little statue box with the original arc reactor gets called through all the way up until Endgame. Yeah. But I like that Pepper ends up saving his life in a roundabout way, because there is a backup arc reactor in the house.
Not as powerful as the one of the new one, but powerful enough that it'll get the job done.
Yeah. Which I like that we've got Tony on the, you know, when he fights the terrorists, he absolutely has all of the power. Mm-hmm. Nothing even touches him, despite the bullet holes. But, you know, he gets, like, a scrape. And that comes from the American military. It doesn't come from the terrorists.
Yeah.
You know, it comes from him accidentally plowing into a fighter on his escape. Mm. But, you know, now he has to think about the sacrifice it takes for being a hero.
Yep. Even Jarvis is warning him, hey, this arc reactor was not meant to power this suit, or it's not going to power very long. You know, Tony's just going to go for it anyway, because he knows what Stain will do if he succeeds.
Yeah, and the one thing that we don't really think about is how much collateral damage is on that freeway?
Yeah.
It's the one thing, for all the talk of collateral damage and civilian casualties in this film, we once again kind of gloss over it. Because, yeah, there is that scene where Tony saves the family in the car. Mm-hmm. But there are, you know, cars careening off of the Ironmonger suit and flipping in the air. There are, you know, crashes that we see, like, or hear off screen. We never get to see what happens to those people. We never get the collateral damage count from this battle, or most of them, honestly.
I just want to backtrack a bit while you finish your thought, is that, you know, you get the Mark II suit, and you see Rhodey look at it and think, next time. No, not you anyway.
Yeah, that not is with kind that of face. One thing.
Not with that face.
Not with that face, you don't get to do that. But, yeah, that is a good moment in the movie, because it's there to tease the audience. Like, they weren't joking. You know, we mentioned before, they had told the audience, if you go see this movie, you get more movies.
Yeah, I
remember. But the fact that they put it in the film.
Yeah, I'm sitting there, and I see Rory look at the suit and say, put it on, next time. Oh, that's what they're going to do. And, you know, yeah. And then we get Don Cheadle.
You know, again, a better choice. We get the typical climactic battle as some of the later films would kind of go away from this a little bit. But, you know, we do have the typical, you know, you've got your suit, I've got my suit.
The big CGI battle that's in every Marvel movie.
Yeah. But the thing is, the thing I like about this battle thematically, I mean, the effects are amazing. CGI still holds up. All glory to the special effects team. Yep. And the stunt team. And all the other people who put their hard work into making that epic, because it is. Thematically, though, this is really Tony learning the sacrificial part of being a superhero.
Yeah, but you can also put that it's also part of the PTSD to wanted to die for a reason, not just die as being captured by terrorists, you know?
But, you know, his original idea is not that he's going to die. He tells Pepper, get in there, overload the arc reactor, I'm gonna get off the roof. As soon as I'm clear, you blow it. And we have no reason to believe he's misleading Pepper. Mm-hmm. He seems to fully believe in his promise. You know, I got a little bit of juice left in this thing. I'm going to punch it. I'll be clear. You take it out. It's going to take out the Ironmonger suit. I'll be fine. And then Stain gets the upper hand. You know, he destroys the rest of the Iron Man suit to the point that
he's also
be able to fly off of it.
Yeah, Tony's also taking the suit off because the arc reactor in his chest can't handle the suit anymore. So he's already halfway undressed, as it were, when Stain attacks again.
Yeah. So, you know, here he is faced with a choice. You know, he's stuck on this roof. He's not getting off. Do you tell Pepper to push the button? Knowing that it's going to, I mean, we're led to believe that this is an EMP, that this is what he's going to do. It's going to be an EMP. It's going to shut down any tech in the vicinity. That is his plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his plan was not necessarily to kill Stain, because Stain would have been able to survive without the suit. I think what he wanted to do was kill the suit.
Yeah,
and that's why he needed to get off the roof, because it will actually kill him. It will kill the technology that is keeping him alive.
Yep.
And he makes that choice anyway.
And, you know, love the villain speech from Stain in the suit, you know. You made this technology and I'm going to kill you with it.
And also deleted scene, there is a longer version of that villain speech and it brings up some interesting points.
Go ahead.
That Stain really does think, and he says it at various parts in the movie, you know, your father gave us the atom bomb, and where would we be without that? And, what a beautiful invention. And in the deleted scene, you know, the extended cut of that scene is he reiterates to Tony, like, because there's a bit where, like, Tony gets the upper hand and they're both laying dying on the roof. It's not quite as climactic as the ending we get with, you know, Pepper push the button. It actually ends with, like, Stain being crippled and laying there trying to get out of the suit before it falls. And Tony trying to save him, even after all that. You know, he still wants to save the human inside.
Mm-hmm.
And Stain tells him that... we made something beautiful. We gave something beautiful to the world. And he's not talking about, like, arc reactor technology, which goes on to the, you know, throughout the rest of the MCU to be, like, the amazing thing that powers the world.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about...
the weapons.
Death. You know, death is the... I mean, you want to talk about Thanos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Stain is the human version of that. You know, look at all this beautiful death we have brought to the world. And Tony has chosen the opposite side at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to live off of death, you know.
Preserving life versus causing death.
Yeah. And the cut that we get, you know, the actual theatrical cut, Stain still has the upper hand and Tony has to make the decision. I am dangling above the arc reactor. Either Stain kills me or I have Pepper take this moment to take him out but it's also going to kill me. It will shut down the arc reactor, saving, you know, powering my heart and keeping the shrapnel away.
Now, one could argue that if Stain had not opened the suit up, he would have survived that shock.
Yeah. He had to get in Tony's face and, like, you know, I've got to see him with my own eyes kind of thing. Also, Tony kind of did pull the electronics for his heads-up display.
Well, that was the only way to slow him down.
Yeah. But I do not think that Tony's original plan was kill Stain.
No.
But, you know, Tony has that choice to make. And interestingly, so does Pepper.
Yeah. She could have not done it just to make sure Tony didn't die. Because, you know, say what you will. Yes, boss, but it's also, you know, she actually does care about the guy.
Yeah. And the thing is that, you know, good for Gwyneth Paltrow and how she plays that moment. Because you can see it that she's like, you know, it's Tony or the rest of the city or maybe the rest of the world.
Needs of the many versus the needs of the few, or the one, yeah, in this case.
I mean, she gets her Spock on at that point, but, you know, and it doesn't look like it's a choice that Pepper just throws away.
No. Like, it's a hard choice for her to make.
But Pepper is a good person, and this is the first we see of her in what will later become her superhero role.
Yeah.
You know, that Pepper in this moment, you know, you want to talk about Thor's hammer choosing the worthy. This is Pepper's moment of proving her worth to wear the Iron Man suit later.
Yeah.
She is willing to make the hard choice for humanity and the hard sacrifice for humanity.
And, yeah, and then, you know, we get Stain getting electrocuted. Maybe he would have survived being electrocuted if he hadn't fallen into the arc reactor. Maybe.
Yeah, if you hadn't blown up the entire, you know, ceiling trying to kill Tony and weakening the structural integrity, you might have survived that.
And then they could have easily explained, you know, half of L.A. being in a blackout with, oh, yeah, our arc reactor blew. We were trying to do something with it.
Yeah.
And Stain would have been arrested, probably going to jail, probably would have shown up in a later movie.
Yeah, but he would have been arrested on the down low by S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
I do like, speaking of S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, we get one last return from Coulson here at the end.
Give him the alibi.
The alibi. You know, we've already forged papers to prove you were on your yacht. We've already forged papers for 50 people saying that they were on the yacht with you. You know, we've done it. All you have to do is get up there and just read this.
And S.H.I.E.L.D. has enough agents that they could pull people saying these people were on the yacht.
Yeah, you can just imagine Linda May showing up and being like, yes, I was there. I was in a bikini. I was dancing. It was fun.
And Fitzsimmons.
No further questions. but, you know, I also like that they have a plan for what happened to Stain.
He was in an airplane. It crashed.
Yeah, you know. Small aircraft have such a horrible safety record. You know, he was on vacation. He never made it back. Oh, well. Lost at sea or whatever.
Yeah, and a nice reference to the comic by saying Iron Man is a bodyguard.
Yeah, which is, you know, part of Tony's cover in the comic. Is saying that the Iron Man suit is actually a robotic bodyguard for Tony Stark.
Or a man in a suit that he keeps the identity secret.
Yeah.
Depending on which version of the comic you're reading.
Yeah, it does go back and forth sometimes in the comic. But, you know, here's where we get one last glimpse of Tony's hubris.
Yeah.
The one thing Tony hasn't really learned from this is he's going to go out there and he's going to take full credit.
I am Iron Man. And that line, again, the ultimate callback.
Yeah. And then it's fun again. Yeah. We get the song.
You could not have done this movie without playing some Black Sabbath. People would have rioted in the streets.
Yeah, I do like that they were able to get the rights to the song and be able to use it. In fact, its inclusion in the trailer was one of the big selling points.
Yep.
So, to wrap it up, he finally does tell people. He becomes one of the few people in the MCU who does not have a secret identity. Mm-hmm. And it's basically him and Steve Rogers, pretty much. Yeah. I like the way they wrapped it up. And then, of course, we do get the post-credit scene we've talked about before. Nick Fury comes in and says, you know...
I'm debating whether to cut this part out and put it
at the end of the credits.
I'm not going
to
do that.
I'll leave that up to you. However, I do like the fact that we do get that now infamous and calling card of that post-credits scene.
Really talking about the Avengers Initiative.
You know, yeah, but I do like that the other line Fury says is basically like, you know, you're too full of yourself.
Yeah.
Do you think you're the only one? And at the moment...
We didn't really know what he meant by that. Like, you could, he's joking about the other superhero movies that are out there. We would learn later on, Captain America, Captain Marvel... They already existed. Even Ant-Man existed before Iron Man became public.
Yeah. The original Ant-Man. Yeah.
Yeah, the original, the first Ant-Man.
Yeah, the first Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Hank and Jan.
Yeah. But it's interesting because that one little statement and that one little promise on top of the thing with War Machine, was such a tantalizing promise of, are they going to make good on this?
And not a lot of people thought it was going to, people thought this was going to be a one and done film because they didn't think the movie was going to make a lot of money. You know, Iron Man movie? Really? And it did. It became one of the biggest movies that year.
And not only was it a movie that made a lot of money, it's a good movie.
It is. Fast forward a few months to the Incredible Hulk movie with the cameo from Robert Downey Jr. at the end of that movie, because this movie is in continuity even though they changed the actors.
Yeah.
And he straight up says, I'm putting a team together.
He has bought into Nick Fury's line. Whatever Fury says to him after it cuts absolutely sells Tony Stark on the idea of the Avenger Initiative.
Yep. Things change between Iron Man 1 and 2, but we eventually get to the Avengers happening in a few years from this point.
Yeah, and honestly, by the time... even though Incredible Hulk was not as well received, and I think criminally so, I don't know. It's been a while since I've watched it. Maybe when we do the rewatch for that, I'll discover I was wrong. But
that movie is not owned by Disney, so we're going to have to find a different way to watch it.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Maybe when I rewatch it on my own and mention it at some point in the future on the show. But even though that wasn't as well received, the idea that there's Robert Downey Jr., there's Tony Stark, mm-hmm. I'm putting together a team. And suddenly we realize, like, oh, they're actually serious about this.
They're all in on this.
They're trying to make this a thing. They are trying to make Fetch happen.
Yeah.
I think that even though that particular movie did not do as well with the general public, I think the hardcore fans suddenly took notice at that point in the Hulk and went, oh my God, we could really have the thing we've always wanted to have.
All these superheroes in one movie. It take 10 years, but we got it.
And honestly, I'm gonna say, I cried at the opening of Avengers because I was like, I can't believe I'm actually watching this. Like, this has really happened now.
Yeah.
The idea of all these comics that I grew up with, that I wanted to see on the big screen, not necessarily the comics I really wanted to see on the big screen. I'm still waiting for an X-Men movie worth watching. Don't at me. I am still waiting for an X-Men movie worth watching.
Well, with Disney in control now, that might happen. We have to wait a few years.
Honestly, now that we've done the MCU Sony crossover to give us the new Spider-Man movies, after Spider-Man Homecoming, I turned to a friend again with tears in my eyes at the end of that movie and said, I finally saw a good Spider-Man movie. I never thought it was going to happen. Don't at me. I do not like any of the Spider-Man movies up until that point. The non-Raimi movies got a little better for me, at least the first one. So I'm hopeful in the future that some of the new acquisitions from Fox, that one day we might, because Captain Marvel is in the MCU now.
Yeah.
We could finally have Rogue's real origin story.
Yeah.
And her full power set. I desperately want that. We might one day get a Fantastic Four that isn't awful.
Yeah.
We might one day get some of these other, they're talking about, rebooting Blade now, and, they're talking about bringing in some of these other ones. We've gotten the TV shows.
Yeah, we know that a Blade movie is happening. They have said something about an MCU Deadpool movie. So it's like...
Which would be great.
Yeah, and they supposedly are keeping Ryan Reynolds.
I want to see it. I love everything about Deadpool, especially Ryan Reynolds. Keep him in charge of things, and I'm okay with it. I have great hopes. I like what they're doing to expand into more niche movies.
Yeah,
Doctor Strange was a niche character, and they brought him in before Endgame.
Look at Ant-Man. Ant-Man was a niche character.
Ant-Man was an even more niche character than Doctor Strange. Yeah.
And they made it work as a heist movie.
Yeah, which is not something they had done before. They went all in with, just like, let's bring in Taika Waititi and just let him do whatever he wants. Yes, please.
He's doing it again. We're also getting, Jane Foster as Thor.
I never thought they would do that.
With Natalie Portman. I thought they were done with Natalie Portman.
Yeah. I'm liking that they're willing to get a little more obscure, that they're willing to switch up the formula. All these people exist in the same universe. They could meet each other, but they don't have to.
And this also, with the MCU, it started something great, but it started a lot of bad copycats.
Yeah.
DC tried it. It didn't work. The Dark Universe, Universal tried it. It failed miserably.
And I hear they're hoping to try again on Dark Universe.
The new Invisible Man movie that came out not too long ago.
Yeah, which I still want to see, because I am down for that. I'm going to respect the original. They're not really responsible for what other people do with an idea.
No, they saw what was happening and say, we want some of that money too, but really didn't want to do the work for it. That was the problem. Marvel did the work for it. No one thought Iron when in 2008, we didn't think we would get the Avengers or where we would go now, where we are now.
We didn't think... I mean, a phase three of the MCU, are you kidding me? You know?
Granted, right about now, we will be gearing up for phase four with Black Widow. Granted, circumstances being what they are, we're not getting it till the end of the year, but you know,
yeah, we may have to wait a little longer for that phase four than we thought. But even if this was all we got, man, we got more than enough.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, there's MCU movies that I do not like as well as others.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure there's any MCU movie that I actually, like, hate. That I'm like, oh, I do not want to watch that ever again.
Thor 2?
Even that one has some things I like. It's not my favorite, but there are things in that I don't want to write it entirely off. Mostly being the language work by David Peterson. Hi, David! I would not want to lose that, because that was some good work there.
The fact that this movie is now more relevant because of Endgame than it ever was when it first came out.
Yeah, in retrospect, there is a lot in this movie that I have a much deeper appreciation for than, you know, like, oh, what does he want to do when he first gets back to America? Cheeseburger. Oh yeah, that's such a cliche. And now you're like, cheeseburger.
His daughter wants a cheeseburger. Oh God.
I want a cheeseburger too. You know, yeah, I mean.
Although I think more people would have laughed if Morgan had said that she wanted a shawarma.
Yeah. Shawarma is maybe the more memorable joke, but it's not as specific
to Tony.
To Tony. I mean, Tony is the one that suggests the shawarma, so it is still to Tony, but I wanted to see that there was a point in the future where Tony invented the shawarma burger. Yeah, like, instead of like a bacon cheeseburger, it's like shawarma meat on top of cheese on top of a burger. So I don't know.
You're going into Ron Stoppable Knuckle territory.
That is my favorite thing about Ron Stoppable is the Knuckle. Yes.
After we recorded last week's episode, she actually made a Knuckle.
Yeah, I did. The thing is, I'm like a weird food junkie. I'd like, you're like, this is a monstrosity that should not exist, and I'm like, yes, and I must have four of them right now.
So yeah, okay.
Back
on the subject of, so yeah, excuse me. Iron Man. So, does this movie still have the magic? I say yes, definitely.
I say even more than it originally had. Especially, I appreciate this movie so much more in retrospect, knowing what it became.
What it led to, yeah.
All the stuff it made possible. All riding on the back of this one goofy little second string Marvel hero.
And how many movies call back to events in this movie? Movies that aren't even out yet that will call back to this movie.
Good grief. Events related to this movie and Tony Stark just showed up in Far From Home, the first post of Endgame film.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, we get the new origin story for Mysterio, and it has to do with things Tony Stark was doing at this point in time, or even earlier.
A one-off character. We talked about him. I'm not Tony Stark. And he's the main villain in Spider-Man Far From Home.
Yeah.
The fact that they called back to this. I'm in the theater, I was like, oh, wow, that is a deep cut.
It absolutely is. And I love every minute of it. And I hope to get more, you know?
Again, who knows we know that the Mandarin is supposed to show up in Shang-Chi. So that's, again, another reference to this movie.
The real Mandarin?
As far as I'm aware, they said it's going to be the real Mandarin this time. Again, right. When we get to Iron Man 3, whenever that is, we'll talk about the Mandarin. So I think that's all we can say about Marvel Studios' Iron Man. Anything else you want to add to it?
You know what? If you're going to be stuck at home, do an MCU rewatch. Start from the beginning. If you've got little ones that haven't really been introduced to it yet, introduce them now. It's a good time as any.
Language warning.
There's a lot of language warning.
A lot of these other movies tend to throw swears like they were free, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, if you have an age-appropriate little one, you know, let's say that.
What is this? You know, what is this? We're the Avengers. It's like, okay, we're gonna. There isn't a video on YouTube of every time they said the SH word in these movies. Language. Language.
Anyway, yeah, if you've got, like, you know, preteens or teens or whatever that haven't really watched the old ones or saw them when they were younger and maybe don't remember them as well, yeah, it's good family-ish viewing for an older child.
Or at least if you have the kids and explain to them these are grown-up words, you don't say them.
Yeah. Because parent is up to you.
I've seen all of these movies in the theater, and each and every one of them had kids in the audience, so I don't think the parents are really caring about it. They're kids,
and sometimes
not my problem.
Babies.
Yeah.
Sometimes babies.
I can't say, I'm not going to tell someone how to parent their child.
But anyway. I will tell someone, don't bring a baby to a movie theater when that's a thing again, hopefully.
With loud noises that could potentially damage their developing ears.
Yeah, and it's not good for the kid.
And then they cry, and then everyone's upset. Because you.
Because of you, parent. No, anyway.
So anyway, that's all we can say about Iron Man. Again, if you're home...
Well, I got some more I could say on Phil Coulson. I mean, if you just want to keep this thing going, I mean, everybody's stuck at home. What else are they going to do? I've got some fanfic here I could read if you want
to
really get into it.
Welcome to our 6-hour podcast on TV's Obsession with Clark Gregg.
Someday.
You know, when comic conventions become a thing again.
Hopefully. He's one I've never met, and I would love to. Anyway, okay, so we're gonna wrap this up, and coming off of this superhero stuff, what do you got for us next week, Tuesday?
So, let's talk about another superhero. So take this. A rich guy goes away, trains for all of his life, comes home, and finds that his hometown is corrupted. And he has to put on a costume to get rid of the corruption in his town. What do you think about that?
I think that Disney doesn't own that one yet.
I'm not talking about what you're thinking of. I'm talking about one of the heroes that inspired that guy. Disney did a series about the character of Zorro.
Oh!
Yes. 1960, we're going to take a look at the movie based on that series, The Sign of Zorro. Now, there's a little bit of history to this one. After the success of Davy Crockett, which was a compilation film of their television series, Walt decided, if this compilation movie works, why not another compilation movie? And combined the entire first season of Zorro into one movie. That's a lot.
That sounds like it's going to be fun.
So, yes, we are going to talk about Zorro next week. Hopefully you guys will be on board with us. So we'll talk to you guys next week about that. Anything else you want to say?
I think there's only one thing left to say.
That was
bye.
Yeah.
Disney doesn't own them yet either.
Thank you for listening to Rewatching the Magic. We invite you to keep the magic going by joining the conversation online. Find us on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic, on Twitter at Rewatch the Magic, and of course, find all new episodes at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Until next time, remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.